Dr. Viraj has authored many books and directs the work of the Princeton Forum on South Asian Ministries. Pastor Anand and his wife, Lily, make their home in Princeton, New Jersey. They have two grown children, and Dr. Viraj will be sharing with us today about reaching our Hindu neighbors, and later on he and Mrs. Viraj will help us in our visit to a Hindu temple to better understand the Hindu culture and mindset. Now, without further ado, if you would please join me in welcoming the Reverend Dr. Anand Viraj.
I'm very happy to be here in your midst this morning. And let me introduce, if you meet an Indian on the street somewhere, how do you wish them? You wish them this way, and you say, Namaste, right? Now, what does that word Namaste, it's a Sanskrit word, Namaste. It means, when you greet, it says, the God in me greets the God in you. Now, that to me is a very wonderful starting point for any link that we can make whenever you meet a Hindu on the street. Of course, when you walk on the streets in India, I mean here, sometimes you may not know whether he is a Hindu or he's... See, India is a vast country with many religions. So sometimes you may be meeting a Sikh person. He may not accept the fact that you wish him this way. So don't go around and do this for everybody. But you can take for granted those people who have a little mark on their forehead, you can be confident that you go around and say, Namaste. They will immediately say, Namaste. They may not shake hands, you know. Indian people are not that very good at shaking hands and touching each other and all that, hugging, kissing, and, you know. So Indian culture doesn't allow that very much. But if you do this, you've got an opening. So that's the good point of contact. That today, something's happening in the sense, one, of course, our President Obama is in India right now and visiting all these places in India, and it's a very high-level delegation he has taken with him to India to develop closer trade relationships. Now, this season is also, for Indians, it's a festival season. Yesterday was a major festival day for India, what we call the Diwali, Festival of Lights. Now, the temple that we are going to see would have part of that celebration today, but that particular temple where we are going today, they had their Diwali celebration yesterday, Festival of Lights. Festival of Lights is that you light candles and oil lamps and all around your house, you put them to ward away the evil spirit. The idea is that the lights drives away the darkness. Darkness can be anything. It can be evil, it can be demonic forces, it can be sickness, it can be sin, you name it. Hindu concept doesn't define sin as we have it in very clear concept. So they may say anything that is evil or sin can be driven away by the festival of... It's a symbolic act. So how much time do I have? So within that time. So I will talk for maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes. and then leave it open for your questions, and I'll try to provide answers. Now, can anybody say India is mentioned in Bible? Where? Where? Okay. Any guesses? If you turn to Esther. Okay. And read the first chapter, first two verses, somebody, if you can read that for me. Chapter 1, verse 1 and 2.
This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to the coast. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa.
Okay. So, we are part of the biblical lands, aren't we? We are part of that large history where God has been working and leading, bringing light. So, we have a place in the in the Christian scriptures. All right. Now, India. Just take that word, India. Now, if you understand that word, India, it comes from the word. Anybody knows what it is? India means it comes from the word a river. It's a name of a river, Sindhu River. Sindhu River is something that flows, right now it is in Pakistan. It's between Pakistan and India. It's a huge, big river. The recent floods in Pakistan, you hear about that. And that particular river, in the ancient time, in the Persian time, and even Alexander, when he came marching with his armies, he came up to the river and he could not cross over the other side and fight the big continent and people over there, and he had to return back. Because people always said, people who live the other side of the river are Indians, or the name of that river is at that time was Sindhu River. Now, so if you really want to understand the Indian mentality, Indian culture, you have to think in terms of a river. Okay, that river, Sindhu River, has five tributaries, right? Huge tributaries. It starts from Himalayan mountains, actually. The snow melts down, trickles down, flows down, and it forms many tributaries. And finally, this big, mighty Sindhu River that flows down through the parched deserts of Rajasthan, and finally it falls into the Arabian Sea. Now, if you think about this river, you have to think about Hindu mentality. Now, the river, as it starts from there, it's on a cycle. It goes, rain falls down, snow falls down, and it trickles and it begins to flow, and then becomes a mighty river, and then it joins the ocean, and then again it circles back and falls as snow and rain, and again goes back. So, in a way, a Hindu mentality, their idea of truth and all that, is something that is constantly evolving, constantly recycling. There is never a finality to what they are searching. So, if you ask a Hindu, what is the essence of your religion? He would say, I'm searching for truth. He will never say, I have found the truth. Right? Now, if I ask you, you are a Christian, what do you believe in? You can say, I believe in Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. I mean, you can say it in few sentences and your creed or whatever your beliefs in very clear nutshells. But a Hindu may not be able to tell. If you ask a Hindu whether he ever seen his scriptures or the Bible, like how we have a Bible here, many may not have seen it. And because if you ask a Hindu to bring his Bible, it volumes and volumes and volumes, and which of that he can choose as his scriptures, we would know. One part of it, a little poetry, Bhagavad Gita, which is part of this whole collection of Vedas, what they call the Bible of Hindu religion, the myths and epics and a lot of folk tales and all this, that may be there, but that only very few people would follow that and say that is the Hindu scriptures. But there is a vast collection of writings. So there is not really a book on which you can base, this is it, all the Hindu wisdom is based in this book. No. So, compared to Christianity, I mean, we should not really do that, but then in comparative religions, this is a system that we have long time ago given up. We don't compare religion to religion and try to find out that Christianity we believe that, Hinduism what you believe. No, that kind of approach to learning about other faiths, we have given up. Scientifically, in most academic settings, we don't do that. Because the moment I say, even to use the word non-Christian, for them, it would be offensive. So, how would you say people of other faith? People of other living faith. Now, Hinduism probably is the oldest religion in the world, living religion that exists. But Hinduism did not start with a scripture. Hinduism did not start with a founder. There's no founder. It many, many years, centuries, thousands of years, it's something that evolved. If you study the scriptures here, you would find that there is a thread going from beginning till the end, right? It's based in some ways the story of God's people, Abraham, how God called him, led him, and children of Israel, Palestine, promised land, they go into exile, and that's where you read about in Esther. And then you come back, and then Christ comes back, we read about the coming of Christ, and then the formation of the church. And so you can historically trace, I mean, today we are sitting here as a church. We have a long history. We probably can trace historically our faith to some extent. But for Hindus, that is not the basis of their religion. It's not the history that is the basis of religion, but it's so much the cosmology. The world was created. Sun, moon, and stars, and the universe, the whole thing keeps going on and on. And so, in this huge process of cosmology, universe, you as a human being exit somewhere as a little speck. And you are part of this big cycle of universe that keeps evolving, moving ahead. And that is the basis of their faith. So, much of their religion, much of their faith, much of their ethics and morals comes out of this worldview, this mentality that you are part of this great universe and that everyone is in some ways related to something. So, it is not a history that goes on a linear path. Okay, you can say history for Christians, it started with Abraham or Adam and Eve down. We can probably plot it on a calendar and say this is how it was. But for a Hindu, it won't be. For him, everything goes in cycles. The same thing that came into life, it goes back and recycles it and comes back and eons, it keeps on going. And so, even your human life, it doesn't end here. Is there a life after death? Yes, they have a belief in, but then it may continue. You may be reborn again into the world, maybe in the next generation, life. You may be born into a different species. We don't know. It depends on the law of karma. If you really think about Hindu religion and their faith, much of it is very highly logical. It's one of the most rational, logical of the religion. Because remove everything out, but then they have to deal with the question of evil in this world. And cause and effect. If you did something wrong, you have to reap. And so, how do you reap? The only way they could work it out is that in the next life, you may be born, maybe as an animal. And so, it's something what they call the karmic effect that continues and continues. And maybe you may be born a reincarnation so many times before you finally you are born as a Brahmin, the highest form of human experience. After that, if you are born as a Brahmin, you have reached the highest achievement in your moral life, in your ethical life, in your perfect life, that eventually when you die, you join with Brahman. Right? So if you think about it, it's very rational, very logical, highly meaningful for a Hindu. So, for us to understand that, it's going to be extremely difficult because for us, everything is neatly packaged and given to us, right? It's easy to understand. Jesus Christ came into this world. He saved me. He forgave my sin. I accept the Lord Jesus Christ in my heart. I'm going to heaven. Boom. There ends my life, right? Now, you cannot say that to a Hindu because he's never sure the guarantee, the assurance that you and I have in our hearts about our life, he would never have. So what he has to do constantly is to be on a pilgrimage in search of truth. So if you go to India, everybody is on a pilgrimage. Whole country is on a pilgrimage. Every little mountain, a hill, or a place, or a river, or that place, or this place is full of pilgrimage. People move from place to place trying to find peace and doing certain things, certain rituals they think that they earn the merit they deserve so that in the next life they'll be born into a higher caste. I know how many of you probably don't know about the caste system here in Hinduism. This is because of that. Now, why you think there are so many Indians here, but very few Christians here, right? I mean, our church, if you come, you will be so surprised. Morning service, if we have this many people in our church, we'll be very happy. We don't have many Indian Christians here. I mean, statistics says it's about 2 or 3%. But recently it has gone up. But in the census, the government suppresses the figure. The unofficial figures, the people who, missions people who did the research, they think it is anything between 10% and 12% Christians are there in India. And it's increasing, multiplying. But the government doesn't want to publish these actual figures. The fear, because, you know, the backlash will be there, which is already happening in India. There is a lot of persecution that is happening. See, one of the things that I would want to warn you, when you meet people around here, especially the temples and Hindus here, especially those folks, today morning we are going to a temple, Durga temple, we are going to be meeting people from a particular state in India, Orissa. They are called the Narayanans. It's a sect within Hinduism. And the people around here in New Jersey, central New Jersey, are fanatical Hindus. These people raise a lot of money to persecute Christians in India. Send a lot of money, raise money, send it over there to burn churches, burn, kill pastors, evangelists, because the church is spreading like wildfire. Probably it happens in China also. I think underground churches, many churches are growing. But in India, there are many, many churches are being built, especially in the remote areas, in the tribal areas. And these Hindus claim these tribal people are their people, but they were not originally part of Hindu religion. But they would want to claim that they are part of their religion, and so they go down and burn these churches down and beat up the pastors when they worship service there. They charge in and then, you know, beat up people. This is an endless problem. I get mail, regular mail, persecution newsletter about India. What is happening week after week, I get a newsletter. And it will list the name of the pastor, the name of the church, and name of the people who attacked, and ask us to write letters to the chief minister, whom you would call governor here, of that particular state, protest against these things. And so we do that. A lot of we Christians from here write letters there. So we get this kind of things here. Now, that sort of thing happens from here. So when you are, of course, Hindus are very nice, very open and all that. Even if you go this morning to the temple, they'll welcome you. But back of your mind, you need to keep in mind, because they think that, I mean, of course, you are Chinese, so you are you come from a culture, so you are safe. But if I, as a Christian, go and try to introduce myself as a Christian to a Hindu, he would think I'm a traitor. I have, working against the national interests of India. And so, I mean, he may welcome me, but in back of his mind, I'm someone who is working against their interests. So, these are some things that we need to keep in mind. Now, let me come one other thing. Now, the temples that we go, the Durga temple. In Hindu religion, probably you know there are a number of deities. But there are principal gods, the major gods you would have. One is, of course, Brahman. Brahman, a god, a force, really. You cannot define Brahman. He's the creative force. And the other one is Vishnu, and the other one is Shiva. See, these are the three people who have three big roles in the world. Brahman creates everything. When they say Om, they use the word Om. It has in that creation, preservation, destruction. So these are the three forces that we... It's like God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, right? In some sense. But then you have this creation, preservation, and destruction. Now the last part of it is... So you have Brahman, Vishnu, and Shiva. And Vishnu has incarnation. He comes back into the world every now and then. Krishna is one of the incarnation of Vishnu. And Rama is one of the incarnation of Vishnu. Now the most colorful personalities in these three is Shiva. Now, how do you understand Shiva? His role is basically one of destruction. He destroys whatever that has been created. Now, people don't understand this concept very much. Now, if you go into a Hindu temple, you would see number of idols there. Now, you should not think, we don't have clear understanding. Most Christians do not have a clear understanding of what is an idolatry is about. We think these people are worshipping an idol, a dead figure. No, that is not the understanding. Missionaries, when they came into India, they went on this crusade of breaking down the idols. But that was a basic misunderstanding of idolatry. What they are actually, if you go into the temple this morning, you would see number of idols. That temple is dedicated to Durga. Durga is a female deity. In Hinduism, the power and the Shakti, what you call as feminine aspect of God, what you may say Holy Spirit, it's represented in these kind of figures, female figures. So, Shiva has a wife, Parvati, and that wife may also take on different personalities. And so you would see a female statue which is dedicated to wisdom. Another female statue you would see dedicated to wealth. Another female statue you would see dedicated to power and, destruction. Now, what does Shiva destroys is that in this process of creation, preservation, and destruction, he does recycles. Basically, he does a dance. Right? How is Shiva represented? It's a dance pose, right? Incidentally, the Hadron Collider in Switzerland, that big atomic thing, that symbol is Shiva. Right at the entrance, you see a huge Shiva statue dancing. They said the most colorful, meaningful, mythical symbol that can capture what goes on in this huge Hadron Collider is represented in Shiva. Now, right at the entrance, you see this. The idea is that he destroys, every autumn, once it lives its life, lets out its energy, it goes back into the nature as the primordial stuff, force again. So in the universe, the cycle goes on and on. But in the concept of Hindu religion, Shiva is one who destroys everything. What does he destroy? Basically, he destroys all the idols. All the idols that have no meaning. Are there idols in our religions? Everybody has some idols. So even in Hinduism, if there are certain idols, that has lost its meaning, that has lost its utility, he goes and breaks them down. So that they will be returned, a new life can come. So it's a very meaningful thing, the Shiva dance. It's something that we have to remember. Now, as a Christian, how would you relate to him? You have all Hindu neighbors. How many of you have friends, Hindu friends and neighbors here? Please put your hand. All right. All of you have. Wonderful. Right. Now, how many of you have invited them to your home? Have they come? They have come. All right. How many of you have gone and visited them in their home? Okay, wonderful. When you go and visit them in their home, do you see anything different from your home to their home. They would probably have a shrine in their home, right? Have you seen those shrines? The Hindu shrines? You see, for us, as Christians, we compartmentalize religion. What is religion? What is faith? And what is secularism? It's like you go to office, you work in the office, you say, 5 days you work there. When you come home, you don't want to think about the office. You leave it there. Come home, you enjoy your family and that. So we have this mentality of compartmentalizing everything. But for a Hindu, no. Everything is religion. Everything is part of his life. So when he gets up in the morning, he brushes his teeth, that's part of his religion. Of course, not really, but, you know. They also have, let's say, an interesting Ayudha Puja. The very same equipment with, let's say you work with a computer, desktop. One fine day, you garland that computer and do a puja for it. So that becomes a god for you at that moment. And this has helped you in your life. In the same way, a taxi driver who drives his taxi all through the year, on one particular day he puts a garland for it and then does puja for it and break coconuts in front of his car and say, you have given me life, you have given me, provided me employment for the whole year and sustained my family, so I worship you. I thank you. It's in a way, it's a Thanksgiving festival. But even the very same thing that you used for as an instrument becomes a god for you for that moment. So for a Hindu mindset, everything is connected. You cannot take anything out of religion. And this is something that we as Christians need to learn from that. For us, 1 hour here, we worship God and we feel blessed and we go home. And our religion and our public life don't mesh so much. But for him, even eating a simple meal, even getting up and having ablution in the morning and going to work is part of his life. And so he's not afraid to have, even in some of the Hindu establishment around here, the shops and all that, you would find a small shrine where they do pujas and leave some incense and in every place of work they would have. Because the place of work is very sacred. But of course, when they do that also, their difference between morals and strong ethical morals are not there. It's not so clear-cut because you can still have that picture of idol there, but you can do all kinds of, unethical things there in your business. That also goes on there. Because anyway, as long as God is watching over whatever you do, you are protected kind of thing, you know. So the clear-cut conscious difference that you and I have about moral issues, they may not have. But the fact is, everything is part of religion. That is something that we would need to remember. I will close now. So, the way that we approach a Hindu, I found this very helpful. I would say, I would never go to a Hindu and say, I have the truth on my side. I know for sure this is how it is. I would say, I am also like you, walking towards the truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. For me, that word is very, very important in relating to how would I define truth? It's very difficult to define truth, right? What is truth? For me, what defines truth is what produces life. Anything that produces life, anything that produces meaning, anything that produces new creation, transformation in your life, in my life, in society, the whole creation, for me that is true. And so Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me. I would say to a Hindu, I am also walking towards the truth. So I would put myself in his shoes as a pilgrim. He is searching for truth. So you are walking towards the truth, which produces transformation in your life, in society, in your families. And more than anything else, what would really attract a non-Christian, a Hindu, into Christian fold is your life, your happiness, the blessings that you have in your life. With that, I'll stop and you can...
I'm sure that many of us have some questions for Dr. Deviraj. A microphone has been set up on the floor. If you have a question to ask, you may just make your way to the microphone, introduce yourself, and ask the pastor. You can't pronounce his last name, so Pastor Anand. Right? You can ask a question about Hinduism or how to be friends to us with our Hindu neighbors.
Hi, my name is Mona Patel, and I come from a Hindu family. I'm a Christian. And just what you said at the end where, you know, you say you're on a pilgrimage and a journey of truth. With my cousins, I sent them on a marriage conference. They were having some marriage problems, and they're Hindu. And at the end, it was a Christian marriage conference, and they said, what we see with your God, or with Christianity, is that you serve a personal God who cares about every aspect of our life, as opposed to Hinduism, which is a little bit more general. And they care about your aspects of life, but not to the every detail and every single personal aspect of your life. Just a quick question is, I just wondered, you were, I guess, from a Hindu background? Is that what they said?
My parents were from a Hindu background.
And I just wondered how this conversion process took place in your family.
Yeah, okay. That's a good question. Now, those of you who know about the mission history of India. Now, one of the things that I said was Christians are very few in numbers, statistically in India. Most Christians in India come from what they call the Dalits. What is Dalit? This is in the caste system, right? In the caste system, they're the top class, the Brahmins, and hundreds and thousands of subcastes there. But the four major castes, the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, and Shudras, and those are outside the caste. And most Christians in India are from the people who are either Shudras or untouchable. So 80% of Christians, those who are here also in the U.S., are from that background. So you could be fairly certain that if you meet a Christian, Indian Christian, he probably is from that kind of background. Very few upper caste Christians, I mean, you would find. Christians are not supposed to have caste system. But the years of this caste oppression has gotten into their psyche. So they would even within Christian population around here, they would define them as Christian from this caste, Christian from that caste. And the way they would find out is, you know, they have a very interesting way of finding out what your caste is. Which village you come from, you know. So you say, I'm from that particular place, that district or something, and they immediately know he is your cousin, you know, that in the sense that most people from that region or that village belong to that particular caste. So, my parents, okay, one of the things, of course, I don't want to say this is not to be said outside, but then my mother comes from the Hindu temple. They had what they called the Devadasis. Now, Devadasis is a very atrocious, inhumane system. The Hindus, what they did, they dedicated their girl babies to a Hindu god. And these girl babies are left in the temple to do dance and provide service, you know, all kinds of things for abusive situations. And my mother was, when she was a child, she was redeemed, rescued from one of these temples and brought over to a Christian home. So a lot of, although Hindus would say it's a very benign religion, but there is a lot of evils that goes in the name of religion. So that is one thing. Of course, now it's abolished, but still that system continues in some parts of India. The second thing, my father was a convert from Hinduism. He was a village school teacher. The missionaries, the way they did was to pick up certain people, find some bright young people, send them to boarding school, give them education, and send them back to their village as teachers to start mission school. And so my father was one of the earliest people who started a mission school in his village. And through that, of course, a lot of village people, because of education and health care and all these things, a lot of Hindus, they came into Christianity. So if you go into my village, there is one section, there is a temple also there. Next to that temple, right across there is the church there. So part of the village is Christian, part of the village is Hindu. So my father was one of the earliest catechists of those that church. So, because they were there, then we are Christians. But for them, life was not easy at that time. There was a lot of persecution, and they were driven from their homes, and a lot of their houses were burnt and all that. So it is that goes on still. But for people, my generation, it's now easy because Christians are the most educated people in India right now. Highly educated, advanced, very progressive in their thinking, but then still things are not easy in the remote place. Go ahead. Other question.
Just like, my name is Wen Pin, and I just like to know how much actually the next generation of the Indian young people in the U.S., how much they believe in Hinduism? It's like how much actually you, and the previous generation actually passed their belief into the next generation? Here in the U.S., are there any difference between the here in the U.S. and the young people in the Indian? Because our target actually is the U.S. Indian young people, maybe.
Yeah, now, you are talking about Hindu young people, let's say, who are in the U.S., right? Any Hindu who comes here, he becomes very Orthodox. The culture looks very strange here, American culture. And so, when a Hindu comes here, he thinks that he's a traitor. I mean, anyone who is born in India as a Hindu, he's a privileged person. Punya Bhumi, he was born in a holy land. So, a Hindu, before he comes here, he does a puja, purification ceremony. Even before he comes, he visits the temple, breaks a coconut, pujari, sprinkles some holy water, whatever he does, and sends him over, so he'll be protected. So as after he lives here for 1 or 2 years or something, he goes back. So first thing what he does, he goes to the temple, repurify himself, you know, all the dirt and all. So people who are here think that they are living in a polluted, decadent culture and they must be purified. So they become very Orthodox Hindus. They may not care for their faith while they were there, but when they are here, they are very staunch. So it's very difficult to reach these people here than to reach people over there. So that is something that you need to come. But on the other hand, see a lot of young people who go to colleges, universities. Here, they are open-minded, but to a certain extent, they also enjoy the privileges here, but in their mind, they carry a big, guilty conscience. Oh my goodness, I'm polluting my soul. In my next life, I'm going to be born as a, you know, a dog or a pig or something. So that you have to be aware of this.
My name is Jeff Wissman. Thank you for coming. My wife and I have met and gotten to know a few men from India that have been here working at the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
And one man we met and got to know and more closely, he was here by himself, and he had a whole family back in India.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked unbelievable hours every single day of the week, 7 days a week. That's all he did. And then he'd send most of his money back home.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common? You know, I mean, is that a have you bumped into a lot of Indian men that have come over here and lived that kind of sacrifice over life?
A lot of these people have overstayed their visas. Okay, they don't have work permit and all that. And if you work in an Indian kind of an business establishment, it's highly exploitative situation. They treat their workers very badly, pay them very poorly. So they work long hours. Probably he's making 2-3 hours. Some of these guys who are working on this gas station on Route 1, many, some of these you fellows, you quietly go and ask them. They don't have their visa, so they are working 2 or 3 hours. But when they send all that money back home, that makes a lot of difference, you know. The dollar value is so much. So the sense of ethics, justice, righteousness is not very clear-cut in the Indian mind, because everything is decided. If you are working like that, you know, in your previous life, you did something wrong. So you are reaping now. Okay.
Have you ever heard of the Dr. Ian? Oh, hi, my name is Gabriel.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of the Dr. Ian Stevenson?
Okay, no. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh,
tell.
Oh, never mind. So that would be a long question then.
Uh-huh. Doesn't matter. We'd like to learn. Dr. Stevenson.
Yes, he was. He investigated several dozen cases of alleged reincarnations. He would interview the people, and then he would interview the supposed new lives, and then they would correspond well, like several dozen different cases. So I was wondering what your opinion of those would be, but if you don't know about the cases, you can give your opinion.
Oh, yeah, but there are a lot of people, yes, go ahead. Good question. A lot of Indians, they think they can think about that in the previous life they were, you know, they can say they were there, here, there. One or two people, they claim that they are reincarnation. There are some swamis floating around in India all over. They are all incarnation. They were previously Vishnu or something or his this thing there. So the people claim that, but some extent they could say that, but how clear, definite they can be sure about it, I'm not sure.
Can I ask one more question?
Mm-hmm.
Crap, hold on, I forgot.
Thank you for coming. My name is Fabi Young. I have two questions. First question is, I know Indian doctor that she told me that I saw pictures of human being that they make it as deity. So I don't know how that tied to.
He's a living deity.
Yeah.
He's a living god.
Right. So it is like making a human a god. So how that practice in Hindu, which I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I work as an IT professional, so I come across a lot of Indians. You know, there are a lot of them. So it's just like, you know, you meet a lot of new Indians coming over from India. So how that impact because I believe IT people are very open-minded because they need to be innovative in doing things. So I was thinking, those people would they have open mind for Christianity? How that impact? Because IT industry in India is very popular for people. I mean, a lot of outsourcing is going to India. So how that impact India in general in terms of the Western culture going into India?
Yeah, you're right. Because you have the last estimate was over 10% of healthcare professionals in this country are Indians, quite a lot. And ethnic minorities, we probably are the richest, wealthiest group in this country. Now, we are also highly educated, I mean, a lot of these people, but how did they all get this? It's because of missionaries who brought this education. Hinduism didn't develop this educational system. It's the Christian missionaries who started this, and it's a Western this thing. Are they open to Christian faith? Western education is very secular, right? It doesn't mix religion now with faith so much. So for them it is just very secular, a way to make money, that's about it. So, but they will always go back to their religious faith. Because just because a person is a scientist doesn't mean that he would immediately embrace Christianity, because we have separated that, compartmentalized our faith and religion and science so much. But for them it's still an integrated thing. So they would absorb it, make it part of their thing, and it doesn't make much of a difference. Because some of these people make a lot of money, and when they go into their homes and in their private life, they are very fanatical Hindus, and it doesn't change them very much. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Dhiraj. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we have to end the question and answer time right now. But I'm sure if you have questions and you come to the field trip later on, you can, of course, ask Dr. Dhiraj and Mrs. Dhiraj. They would be very happy, I'm sure, to answer some of your other questions. So.